Hello there, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm Cory Doctorow, and it's Monday, the 30th of March. If I sound a little tired, it's because we got back from San Francisco yesterday, and, well, the baby didn't sleep much on the plane, and she didn't sleep much last night either. I found myself at 3 in the morning saying, Posey, if you go to sleep now, I will give you a performance sports car on your 16th birthday. And she did not go to sleep. So I'm a little tired. But I'm very well. Thank you to everybody who came out to the benefit in San Francisco last Monday, the Electronic Frontier Foundation benefit at the 111 Mina Gallery. Wasn't Rudy Records Reading amazing? I had a fantastic time, and it was so nice to meet so many of you. San Francisco was lovely, as always. I always have a good time there. I quite miss it, actually. I'm a little bummed out today. I had to stop working for the win last week while we were in San Francisco. There just wasn't enough time to go to the Game Developers Conference and work on the book, so I decided my contribution to the book last week was the research I was doing at GDC, but I feel kind of out of the loop or out of the habit now, a little flabby in the old writing muscles, and didn't get around to writing any of it today. I don't think I will, because it's the end of the day here, and I'm just too tired. But I'll get to it tomorrow. Get back on the horse, as they say. What else do I have to tell you about? Well, if you're in Berlin, I might see you this Friday. I'm going in for the day to speak at the Republica conference. Larry Lessig is going to be there, and Jimbo Wales from Wikipedia. It's going to be a really good event. Really nice to see those guys and hear what they have to say, and I hope to meet as many of you as possible while I'm there. I'm only there for the afternoon, unfortunately. I wish it could be longer, but it's not fair to Alice to leave her with the baby overnight if I can get away with a day trip. Let's see, what else do I have to add? Well, I ran some galleys off from Lulu.com. Lulu is the print-on-demand service started by Bob Young, who started Red Hat. And I've got this book, Makers, coming out. Last week I talked to you a little about the fact that I'd been copy-editing it. So I've got this book, Makers, coming out, and I wanted to run off some galleys to hand out in San Francisco. So I used Lulu, and they are some of the most amazing print-on-demand materials I've seen. It was 24 hours. It was an overnight turnaround, and it was still cheaper than having them printed upstairs at the photocopy shop here at my office in London. And they drop-shipped them to my hotel. So I'm planning something a little bigger and more ambitious with Lulu. Depending on how things go, I think I want to do a short story collection with them. I have to negotiate some things with them and see where we can net out. But short story collections don't make a lot of money as it is, so it's a pretty low-risk thing to experiment with. And I thought I'd finally try some self-publishing and see where that takes me. The only other news I have is completely for my own benefit. Feel free to stick your fingers in your ear to hum here. But my accountants put me on double entry bookkeeping this year. I've never done that before, actually tracked money in and money out and compared it to the bank balance and made sure that I was accounting for everything. I actually did that starting on January the 1st, and it's the end of the first quarter, so I balanced my books! I know that this sounds completely meaningless, but it took me like 3 hours this morning, but I actually closed the quarter out with being able to account for all the money I made this quarter and all the money I spent this quarter. It feels really good. It's like being the master of your destiny. I heartily recommend it to anyone who's ever worried about their finances. Do double entry bookkeeping. It's awesome. All right then. Without further ado, I think I will now move on and read to you a little from my novel, Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. Davy haunted the schoolyard. Alan had always treated the school and its grounds as a safe haven, a place where he could get away from the inexplicable, a place where he could play at being normal. But now Davy was everywhere, lurking in the climber, hiding in the trees, peering through the tinsel-hung windows during class. Alan only caught the quickest glimpses of him, but he had the sense that if he turned his head around quickly enough, he'd see him. Davy made himself scarce in the mountain, hiding in the golem's cave or in one of the deep tunnels. Marcy didn't come to class after Monday. Alan fretted every morning, waiting for her to turn up. He worried that she'd told her father, or that she was at home sulking, too angry to come to school, glowering at her Christmas tree. Davy's grin was everywhere. On Wednesday, he got called to the vice principal's office. As he neared it, he heard the rumble of Marcy's father's thick voice, and his heart began to pound in his chest. He cracked the door and put his face in the gap, looking at the two men there, Mr. Davenport, the vice principal, with his gray hair growing out of his large ears and cavernous nostrils, sitting behind his desk, looking awkwardly at Marcy's father, his eyes bugged and bagged and bloodshot, face turned to the ground, looking like a different man, the picture of worry and loss. Mr. Davenport saw him and crooked a finger at him, looking stern and stony. Alan was sure, then, that Marcy had told it all to her father, who told it all to Mr. Davenport. Who would tell the world? And suddenly he was jealous of his secret, couldn't bear to have it revealed, couldn't bear the thought of men coming to the mountain to catalogue it for the subject index at the library, to study him and take him apart, and he was afraid. Not of what they'd all do to him, what Davy would do to him. He knew, suddenly, that Davy would not abide their secrets being disclosed. He forced himself forward, his feet dragging like millstones, and stood between the two men, hands in his pockets, nervously twining at his underwear. Alan, Marcy's father croaked. Mr. Davenport held up a hand to silence him. Alan, Mr. Davenport said, have you seen Marcy? Alan had been prepared to deny everything, call Marcy a liar, betray her as she'd betrayed him, make it her word against his. Protect her, protect her father and the school and the town from what Davy would do. Now he whipped his head toward Marcy's father, suddenly understanding. No, he said, not at all this week. Is she all right? Marcy's father sobbed, a sound that Alan had never heard an adult make. And it came tumbling out. No one had seen Marcy since Sunday night. Her presumed whereabouts had moved from a friend's place to Alan's place, to run away, to fallen in a lake, to hit by a car and motionless in a ditch. And if Alan hadn't seen her... I haven't, Alan said. Not since the weekend. Sunday morning. She said she was going home. Another new sound. The sound of an adult crying. Marcy's father, and his sobs made his chest shake, and Mr. Davenport awkwardly came from behind his desk and set a box of Kleenexes on the hard bench beside him. Alan caught Mr. Davenport's eyes, and the vice principal made a shoo and pointed at the door. Alan didn't bother going back to class. He went straight to the Golem's Cave, straight to where he knew Davy would be, must be hiding, and found him there, playing with the bones that lined the walls. "Where is she?" Alan said, after he'd taken hold of Davy's hair and, without fanfare, smashed his face into the cold stone hard enough to break his nose. Alan twisted his wrist behind his back, and when he tried to get up, Alan kicked the legs out from under him, wrenching his arms in their sockets, and he heard a popping sound. "Where is she?" Alan said again, amazing himself with his own calmness. Davy was crying now, genuinely scared, it seemed, and Alan was reveling in the feeling. "Kill you," he whispered in Davy's ear, almost lovingly. "I'll kill you and put the body where no one will find it unless you tell me where she is." Davy spattered a milk tooth, his top right incisor, and cried around the blood that coursed down his face. I'm sorry, Alan, he said, but it was the secret. His sobs were louder and harsher than Marcy's father's had been. "Where is she?" Alan said, knowing. "With Caleb," said Davy. "I buried her in Caleb." He found his brother the island, midway down the mountain, sliding under cover of winter for the seaway. He climbed the island slope, making for the ring of footprints in the snow, and the snow peppered brown with soil and green and grass, and he dug with his hands like a dog, tossing soil, grass, soil, snow, grass through his legs, digging to loose soil, digging to a cold hand. A cold hand protruding from the snow now, from the soil, some of the snow red-brown with blood, a skinny, freckled hand, a fingernail missing, torn off, leaving behind an impression, an inverse fingernail, a hand, an arm, not attached to anything. He set it to one side, dug, found another hand, another arm, a leg, a head. She was beaten, bruised. Eyes swollen and two teeth missing, ear torn, hair caked with blood. Her beautiful head fell from his shaking, cold hands. He didn't want to dig any more, but he had to because it was the secret and it had to be kept, and he buried her in Caleb, piled dirt on grass, snow on her parts, and his eyes were dry, and he did not sob. It was a long autumn and a long winter and a long spring that year, unwiring the market. Alan fell into the familiar rhythm of the work of a new venture, rising early, dossing late, always doing two or three things at once, setting up meetings, sweet-talking merchants, debugging his process on the fly. His first victory came from the Greek, who was no pushover. The man was over 70 and had been pouring lethal coffee and cheap beer down the throats of Kensington's hipsters for decades, and had steadfastly refused every single crackpot scheme hatched by his customers. "Larry," Andy said, "I have a proposal for you, and you are going to hate it."
"I hate it already," the Greek said. His dapper little mustache twitched. It was not even 7 a.m. yet, and the Greek was tinkering with the guts of his espresso delivery system, making it emit loud hisses and tossing out evil congealed masses of sin-black coffee grounds. "What if I told you it wouldn't cost you anything?" "Maybe I'd hate it a little less."
"Here's the pitch," Alan said, taking a sip of the thick, steaming coffee the Greek handed him in a minuscule cup. He shivered as the stuff coated his tongue. "Wow." The Greek gave him half a smile, which was his version of roaring hilarity. "Here's the pitch," he said again. "Me and that punk kid, Kurt, we're working on a community internet project for the market."
"Computers," the Greek said.
"Yep," Alan said.
"Pah," the Greek said.
Anders nodded. "I knew you were going to say that. But don't think of this as a computer thing, okay? Think of this as a free speech thing. We're putting in a system to allow people all over the market, and someday maybe the whole city, to communicate for free, in private, without permission from anyone. They can send messages, they can get information about the world, they can have conversations. It's like a library and a telephone at a cafe all at once."
Larry poured himself a coffee. "I hate it when they come in here with computers. They sit forever at their tables, and they don't talk to nobody. It's like having a place full of statues or zombies."
"Well, sure," Alan said. "If you're all alone with a computer, you're just going to fall down the rabbit hole. You're in your own world and cut off from the rest of the world. But once you put these computers on the network, they become a way to talk to anyone else in the world. For free! You help us with this network. All we want from you is permission to stick up a box over your sign there and patch it into your power. You won't even know it's there, and these customers won't be antisocial. They'll be socializing over the network."
"You think that's what they'll do if I help them with the network?"
He started to say, "Absolutely," but bit it back, because Larry's bullshit antennae were visibly twitching. "No, but some of them will. And you'll see them in here talking, typing, talking, typing, typing, talking. That's how it goes. The point is that we don't know how people are going to use this network yet, but we know it's a social benefit."
"You want to use my electricity?"
"Well, yeah. So, it's not free."
"Not entirely," Alan said. "You got me there."
"Aha," the Greek said. "Look, if that's a deal-breaker, I will personally come in every day and give you a dollar for the juice. Come on, Larry. The box we want to put in is just a repeater to extend the range of the network. The network already reaches to here, but your box will help it go farther. You'll be the first merchant in the market to have one. I came to you first because you've been here the longest. The others look up to you. They'll see it and they'll say, 'Larry has one. It must be all right.'"
The Greek downed his coffee and smoothed his mustache. "You're a bullshit artist, huh? All right. You put your box in. If my electricity bills are too high, though, I'd take it down."
"That's a deal," Andy said. "How about if I do it this morning before you get busy? Won't take more than a couple minutes." The Greek's was midway between his place and Kurt's, and Kurt hardly stirred when he let himself in to get an access point for one of the chip shelving units, before going back to his place to get his ladder and his Makita drill. It took him most of the morning to get it securely fastened over the sign, screws sunk deep enough into the old spongy wood to survive the buildup of ice and snow that would come with the winter. Then he had to wire it into the sign, which took longer than he thought it would, too, but then it was done, and the idiot light started blinking on the box Kurt had assembled. "And what exactly are you doing up there, Al?" Kurt said when he finally stumbled out of bed and down the road for his afternoon breakfast coffee. "Larry's letting us put up an access point," he said, wiping the pigeon shit off a wire, preparatory to taping it down. He descended the ladder and wiped his hands off on his painter's pants. "That'll be $10, please." Kurt dug out a handful of coins and picked out enough loonies and toonies to make $10 and handed it over.
"You talked the Greek into it?" he hissed.
"How?"
"I kissed his ass without insulting his intelligence."
"Neat trick," Kurt said, and they had a little partner-to-partner high five. "I better log into that thing and get it onto the network, huh?"
"Yeah," Anders said. "I'm going to order some lunch. Let me get you something."
What they had done was that they had hacked the shit out of those boxes that Kurt had built in his junkyard of a storefront of an apartment.
"These work?" Alan said.
He had three of them in a big catering tub from his basement that he'd sluiced clean. The base stations no longer looked like they'd been built out of garbage. They'd switched to low-power mini-ATX motherboards and let them shrink the hardware down small enough to fit inside a $50 all-weather junction box from Canadian Tire. Adam vaguely recognized the day's street kids as regulars who'd been hanging around the shop for some time, and they gave him the hairy eyeball when he had the audacity to question Kurt. These kids of Kurt's weren't much like the kids he had working for him over the years. They might be bright, but they were a lot angrier. Some of the girls were cutters, with knife scars on their forearms. Some of the boys looked like they'd been beaten up a few times too many on the streets, like they were spoiling for a fight. Alan tried to unfocus his eyes when he was in front of Kurt's shop, to not see any of them too closely. "They work," Kurt said. He smelled terrible, a combination of garbage and sweat, and he had the raccoon-eyed jitters he got when he stayed up all night. "I tested them twice." "You built me a spare?" Alan said, examining the neat lines of hot glue that gasketed the sturdy rubberized antennae in place, masking the slightly melted edges left behind by the drill press. "You don't need a spare," Kurt said. Alan knew that when he got touchy like this, he had to be careful or he'd blow up, but he wasn't going to do another demo Kurt's way. They'd done exactly one of these at a Toronto District School Board superintendent's meeting, when Alan had gotten the idea of using the school's flagpoles as backhaul and backhaul as testbeds for building out the net. It had been a debacle, needless to say. Two of the access points had been permanently installed on either end of Kurt's storefront, and a third had been in storage for a month since it was last tested. One of the street kids, a boy with a pair of improbably enormous raver shoes, looked up at Alan. "We tested these all. They work." Kurt puffed up and gratefully socked the kid in the shoulder. "We did." "Fine," Adam said patiently, "but can we make sure they work now?" "They'll work," Kurt had said when Alan told him what he wanted to test. That he wanted to test the access points before he took them out to the meeting. "It's practically solid state. They're running off the standard distribution. There's almost no configuration." Which may or may not have been true. It certainly sounded plausible to Alan's lay ear. But it didn't change the fact that once they powered up the third box, the other two seized up and died. The blinking network lights fell still, and as Kurt hauled out an old VT-100 terminal and plugged it into the serial ports on the backs of his big, ugly, bestickered, and SIG-burned PC cases, it became apparent that they had ceased to honor all requests for routing, association, deassociation, DHCP leases, and the myriad of other networking services provided for by the software. "It's practically solid state," Kurt said, nearly shouted after he'd powered down the third box and found that the other two, previously routing and humming along happily, refused to come back into their known good state. He gave Alan a dirty look, as though his insistence on pre-flighting were the root of their problem. The street kid who'd spoken up had jumped when Kurt raised his voice, then cringed away. Now, as Kurt began to tear around the shop, looking through boxes of CDs and dropping things on the floor, the kid all but cowered, and the other three all looked down at the table. "I'll just reinstall," Kurt said. "That's the beauty of these things. It's a standard distro. I'll just copy it over, and biff-bam, it'll come right back up. No problem. Take me 10 minutes. We got plenty of time." Then, 5 minutes later, "Shit, I forgot this one had a different MOBO than the others." "MOBO?" Alan said, amused. He'd spotted the signs of something very finicky gone very wrong, and he'd given up any hope of actually doing the demo. So he'd settled in to watch the process without rancor, and to learn as much as he could. "Motherboard," Kurt said, reaching for a spool of blank CDs. "Just gotta patch the distribution, recompile, burn it to a CD, and reboot, and then we're on the road." 10 minutes later. "Shit." "Yes," Alan said. "Back off, okay? I'm gonna call them and let them know we're going to be late." "We're not gonna be late," Kurt said, his fingers going into claws on the keyboard. "We're already late," Alan said. "Shit," Kurt said. "Let's do this," Alan said. "Let's bring down the two that you've got working and show them those and explain the rest." They'd had a fight, and Kurt had insisted, and Alan had suspected that he would, that he was only a minute or two away from bringing everything back online. Alan kept his cool, made mental notes of the things that went wrong, and put together a plan for avoiding all these problems the next time around. "Is there a spare?" Alan said. Kurt sneered and jerked a thumb at his workbench, where another junction box sat, bunny ear antennae poking out of it. Alan moved it into his tub. "Great," he said. "Tested, right?" "All permutations tested and ready to go. You know, you're not the boss around here." "I know it," he said. "Partners." He clapped Kurt on the shoulder, ignoring the damp, gray, grimy feeling of the clammy t-shirt under his palm. The shoulder under his palm sagged. "Right," Kurt said. "Sorry." "Don't be," Alan said. "You've been hard at it. I'll get loaded while you wash up." Kurt sniffed at his armpit. "Whew," he said. "Yeah, okay." When Kurt emerged from the front door of his storefront 10 minutes later, he looked like he'd at least made an effort. His mohawk and its fins were slicked back and tucked under a baseball hat. His black jeans were unripped, and he had only one conservative chain joining the wallet in his back pocket to his belt loop. Throw on a clean t-shirt advertising an old technology conference instead of the customary old hardcore band, and you had an approximation of the kind of geek that everyone knew was in possession of secret knowledge, and hence must be treated with attention, if not respect. I feel like such a dilbert, he said. You look totally disrespectable, Alan said, hefting the tub of their access points into the bed of his truck and pulling the bungees tight around it. Punk as fuck. Kirk grinned and ducked his head. Stop it, he said. Flatterer. Get in the truck, Alan said. Kurt drummed his fingers nervously on his palms the whole way to the Bell offices. Alan grabbed his hand and stilled it. Stop worrying, he said. This is going to go great. I still don't understand why we're doing this, Kurt said. They're the phone company. They hate us. We hate them. Can't we just leave it that way? Don't worry. We'll all still hate each other when we get done. So why bother? He sounded petulant and groggy, and Alan reached under his seat for the thermos he had filled at the Greek's place before heading to Kurt's. Coffee, he said, and handed it to Kurt, who groaned and swigged and stopped bitching. Why bother is this, Alan said. We're going to get a lot of publicity for doing this. Kurt snorted into the thermos. It's going to be a big deal. You know how big a deal this can be. We're going to communicate that to the press, who will communicate that to the public, and then there will be a shitstorm. Radio cops, telco people, whatever, they're going to try to discredit us. I want to know what they're liable to say. Christ, you're dragging me out for that? I can tell you what they'll say. They'll drag out the four horsemen of the infocalypse, kiddie porn, terrorists, pirates, and the mafia. They'll tell us that any tool for communicating that they can't tap, log, and switch off is irresponsible. They'll tell us that we're stealing from ISPs. That's what they say everyone tries this. Philly, New York, London, all around the world, same song. Alan nodded. That's good background. Thanks. I still want to know how they say it, what the flaws in the expression of their arguments are. And I want us to run a demo for some people who I could never hope to sway. That's a good audience for exposing the flaws in the show. This'll be a good prep session. So I pulled an all-nighter and busted my nuts to produce a demo for a bunch of people who don't care about it? Thanks a lot. Alan started to say something bitchy back, but then he stopped himself. He knew where that would end up, a screaming match that would leave both of them emotionally overwrought at a time when they needed cool heads. But he couldn't think of what to tell Kurt in order to placate him. All his life he'd been in situations like this, confronted by people who had some beef, some grievance, and he had no answer for it. Usually he could puzzle out the skeleton of their cause, but sometimes, times like this, he was stumped. He picked at the phrase, "I pulled an all-nighter." Kurt pulled an all-nighter because he'd left this to the last minute, not because Alan had surprised him with it. He knew that, of course, was waiting then for Alan to bust him on it, to tell him, this is your fault, not mine, to tell him, if this demo fails, it's because you fucked off and left it to the last minute. So he was angry, but not at Alan, he was angry at himself. A bunch of people we don't care about, what was that about? Ah, Kurt knew that they didn't take him seriously in the real world. He was too dirty, too punk as fuck. Too much of his identity was wrapped up in being alienated and alienating. But he couldn't make his dream come true without Alan's help either. So Alan was the friendly face on their enterprise, and he resented that. Feared that in order to keep up his appearance of punk as fuckitude, he'd have to go into that meeting cursing and sneering, and that Alan would bust him on that too. Alan frowned at the steering wheel. He was getting better at understanding people, but that didn't make him necessarily better at being a person. What should he say here? That was a really heroic effort, Kurt, he said, biting his lip. I could tell you put a lot of work into it. He couldn't believe that praise this naked could possibly placate some of Kurt's heroic cynicism, but Kurt's features softened and he turned his face away, rolled down the window, lit a cigarette. Thought I'd never get it done, Kurt said. I was so sleepy I felt like I was half-baked, couldn't concentrate. You're up all night because you left it to the last minute, Kurt, Alan thought. But Kurt knew that, and was waiting to be reassured about it. I don't know how you get as much done as you do. Must be really hard. It's not so bad, Kurt said, dragging on his cigarette and not quite disguising his grin. It gets easier every time. Yeah, we're going to get this down to a science someday, Alan said. Something we can teach anyone to do. That would be so cool, Kurt said, and put his boots up on the dash. God, you could pick all the parts you needed out of the trash, throw in a little methodology at them, and out would pop this thing that destroyed the phone company. This is going to be a fun meeting, Alan said. Shit, yeah. They're going to be terrified of us. Someday. But it starts today. All right, then. Talk to you next week.